Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
Save on stuff you really need and stuff you bought for fun. Stuff you've always really wanted this holiday at Amazon. Stuff that is discounted if you're naughty or you're nice. Stuff to buy your grandma who drinks her Chardonnay with ice. Stuff to make you big and strong. Stuff we can't name in this song. Stuff for lawns and decking halls. Save big on stuff at Amazon. Stuff.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 13th of October, these are our main stories. Israel orders more than 1 million people in northern Gaza to move south ahead of an expected ground offensive. But the UN warns the evacuation order will have devastating humanitarian consequences in such a densely populated and impoverished area. The Republican nominee drops out of the race for US House Speaker, creating more chaos for Congress. Also in this podcast, the biggest takeover in gaming history has just been completed. And
the fact that we can now make some sort of paving slabs, paving stones from the lunar regolith is something that's really exciting, and it opens up a whole world of possibility.
Plans to build roads on the moon to help us humans live there. Some residents of northern Gaza are fleeing after an Israeli warning that they should move south. Hundreds of cars and trucks, heavily loaded with possessions, even mattresses, are heading south into what is already one of the most densely populated parts of the world. Many fear they'll be caught up in the anticipated Israeli ground offensive, which is expected any day now. Many families are walking on foot. Some are bringing along their cows, camels, sheep and donkeys. Gaza resident Suzanne Barzak recorded this message as she was packing her bags to leave.
We were hesitant about what we heard. We were very perplexed and confused whether these information are true and what are we going to do, because the shelling didn't stop since then. There is no safe passage to go, but many of my friends have already moved and have already reached the southern areas. We want to make sure first that there is a safe passage so we can all move here. We are here like five families of around 30 people. We are packing and getting ready to move, but many people are still hesitant about this. They consider this a part of the psychological war on the Gazan civilians, and some others are telling like this is a part of a bigger plan of immigration towards Egypt, Sinai, and they are choosing to stay in their houses whatever happens.
The UN is warning that it will be impossible for the population of northern Gaza, more than 1 million people, to leave within 24 hours, as the Israelis are demanding, especially when they're under constant bombardment, suffering from food, water and fuel shortages, and when thousands have been wounded and entire neighbourhoods destroyed by Israeli warplanes. A spokesman for the Israeli Defence Forces, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, defended the announcement.
People should listen. If we're saying that you should evacuate, the first thing that you should do when you wake up in the morning is take the necessary belongings and evacuate. That would make their situation better. You know, we have the right and we have the obligation to defend the people of Israel. You can't expect Israel not to defend its civilians because Hamas is hiding behind hers.
As we've just heard, the evacuation order has triggered suspicion among some residents. Hamas has called it fake propaganda and urged citizens to ignore it. That's what Amjad Shabat has decided to do.
It needs months to uproot 1.1 million people to evacuate from the northern of Gaza to the southern Gaza in less than 24 hours. No, we're not leaving. It's better to die under the rubbles of our houses than to leave our houses to be bombed. This is hilarious. This is hilarious. Where are we going to go? To Sinai? To Egypt? Where are we going to go? No, we're not leaving. We're staying in our houses. Next to where I stay, there is a school that became a shelter of thousands of people. More than 50 people pile up in one room that four is by 4 meters. Where will they go? We believe that this is part of the psychological war that Israel has been targeting us as civilians. If we're not killed by their airstrikes, we're killed by the news that they're asking us to evacuate or to our houses to be threatened or our relatives to be killed.
So some Gazans are staying put, some are fleeing or preparing to flee, but many, like Farah Abo Sedo, are stuck in between, unsure what to do.
I'm seeing the people right now in front of me. They hold in their bags and their things and their papers like they want to run away, but all of them also shocked, like, where we should go. That is the question, where we should go. It's only one city, and it's a small city. There's no place, there's no escape. They bomb us every single night without any mercy. They whip it out a lot of a street, a lot of buildings, a lot of shops. There is nothing left. And the thing is, no one protect us. There is no safe place here. There's a lot of children out there fight, people and pregnant women. What are we gonna do? We got nothing to do right now. No one help us.
We heard there from residents of Gaza as they weigh up that agonizing decision of whether to stay or to flee. So why is Israel ordering people in Gaza to move south? Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is close to Gaza in southern Israel.
Israel's military priority now is to intensify its attacks on Hamas's infrastructure. And one of its key targets is the underground tunnels that Hamas uses to keep itself safe, to store, no doubt, food and fuel, its military supplies for what it knows will be an even greater Israeli assault on the coastal strip. It could also be where they are holding the hostages. But if Israel smashes the tunnels, it will also be destroying the houses, the residential towers, which live above the tunnels. So it is asking people to leave as a matter of urgency. It wants to get on with its military operations. But even in a country at peace, with the greatest of resources, moving more than 1 million people is an almost impossible ask.
Lise Doucette in southern Israel. Well, more accounts have emerged of the atrocities committed by Hamas gunmen who rampaged through southern Israel on Saturday. One of the most horrific massacres happened in the kibbutz of Kfar Aza, one of the last villages to be recaptured by Israeli soldiers. Our correspondent Nick Beek went to meet one of the survivors who says the crimes she witnessed justify a full-scale Israeli ground offensive into Gaza. Just to warn you that Nick's report contains details you may find distressing.
We hear them shooting people, shooting kids, and the people tell them, please no.
From her hospital bed, 22-year-old Netta Portal relives the Hamas massacre in her village. Pins hold together her left leg, where she was shot 5 times. Sitting next to her, failing to stop his tears, her boyfriend Santiago. He's too upset to speak.
We start to hear gunshots. They start one apartment, start to break the windows, break the doors, and start to shoot. You sounds people screaming.
The killers filmed themselves on the loose, murdering dozens in the Jewish community of Far Aza. Trapped in her home, with no Israeli soldiers to be seen, Netta realized the only person who could save her was her dad, who she hadn't spoken to in 6 years. Hiding, staying silent, she managed to message him. "They are close," she writes. "Lock the doors," her dad replies. "Please, answer, please." But the gunmen soon found Netta and Santiago.
"They started to shoot like an old man, like with nothing."
Netta was hit in the hand and both legs.
"And Santiago screamed at me, 'Netta, please stand up, start to run. If you don't stand up, we're going to die, we're going to die.'"
Santiago managed to carry her to safety a few streets away, where they hid under a big pile of rubbish, trying to stay as quiet as possible. Netta texted her dad again. "Dad, they shot me. Help. I'm coming," he replies. When Shimon Portal, a plainclothes policeman, arrived at his daughter's village, he said gunmen shot at children as well as him.
"I took my gun and they started to shoot at me. I shot at them. I don't know if I hit them or not. And four people get from their houses over there and with the AK-47 start to shoot me."
Eventually, Shimon found his daughter near her burnt-out home and drove her and her boyfriend to hospital, leaving behind many bodies. Far Aza, one of many villages targeted last weekend. Netta says Israel must now respond in the strongest possible way.
"They come to kill us. I don't want the Hamas anymore in my life. They need to destroy them one by one. I want peace with all my heart, but I think it's not going to be peace."
Have you been thinking about what may happen to civilians in Gaza if there is a big ground operation by the Israeli military there?
"All what I said, it's for the jihad and the Hamas. My country didn't want to hurt the civilians. I don't think they need to die like I don't need to die. They like me, but we need to fight."
Netta, a survivor of one of the massacres in Israel, speaking to Nick Beek. To the US now, where Capitol Hill has seen more chaos. Just a day after being chosen as a Republican Party's nominee to be Speaker of the House of Representatives, Steve Scalise has pulled out.
"If you look at where our conference is, there's still work to be done. There are still some people that have their own agendas. And I was very clear, we have to have everybody put their agendas on the side and focus on what this country needs."
Mr. Scalise had narrowly beaten the right-wing hardliner Jim Jordan in a secret ballot, but with Republicans only having a narrow majority in the House, he was unable to win over enough of them to replace Kevin McCarthy, who was ousted by Trump supporters earlier this month. So what happens now? Our North America correspondent David Willis explains.
Steve Scalise's decision to withdraw from the race plunges this process into this agonizing process into further chaos. The House can't act on pressing issues such as aid for Israel, aid for Ukraine, or the imminent government funding deadline, which is a little more than a month away at the moment. All the time, there is no leader of the lower house. It's possible that fellow Conservative, the Ohioan Republican Jim Jordan, whom Steve Scalise defeated in a vote on Wednesday, could make another run for the position. Some say it's unlikely, though, that even he would be able to secure the votes he needed from this deeply divided House. So possibly there could be a third contender, somebody from outside the current leadership ranks, perhaps. But it's all a bit of a mess and it's all up in the air right now.
David Willis. It's hoped that one day we humans will return to the moon. The last time anyone set foot there was December 1972 on the Apollo 17 mission. And NASA astronauts could be back as soon as 2025. But what about staying there long term, even building on the lunar surface? The challenge for future landings is that the surface is almost like a powder. That's according to Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, who described what it was like.
At the foot of the ladder, the Lambert beds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder.
There might be a solution, though, and it involves lasers. Scientists are developing a new technology to melt lunar dust to make it into a strong, glassy material that could help visitors get around the moon. Sean Cleaver is the industrial manager of the European project that provides power and life support systems for astronauts. She spoke to my colleague Amol Rajan about this new technology.
It's really exciting to hear that something is being done towards the infrastructure that we're wanting to build up on the moon. So the whole Artemis program is huge. There are so many elements that need to come together. It's not just about the spacecraft, which is the element that I work on, but it's also about thinking about how, once we get to the moon, how are we going to make the best use of the lunar resources? And the fact that we can now make some sort of paving slabs, paving stones from the lunar regolith is something that's really exciting, and it opens up a whole world of possibilities.
Well, if you can do paving slabs, you can do presumably quite complex surfaces that you could potentially build launch pads on.
Absolutely. And that's one of the key elements that I think we're going to start to see in the next decade or so when we return to the moon. Of course, when we go, we're going to need to have habitats, but also maybe launch pads so that we can return our astronauts back to the Earth, and also other sort of structures that we can use to help us carry out the work that we're going to the moon to do. So whether that be scientific or whether that be some sort of mining or exploration, having the capability to build is really quite game changing.
Where has all that got to? The idea of habitats on the moon seems rather distant to most people listening to you right now, I suspect, Sean. Where are the prospects for actually putting, if not whole ecosystems, habitats on the moon? How far away is it?
Well, it's getting really close now. So last year we saw the launch of Artemis 1. That was the test mission to fly the spacecraft Orion around the moon and return it to the Earth. Now, next year we will be doing that again, but with a crew of 4 astronauts. So they won't be landing on the moon next year, but they will be orbiting the moon a little bit like they did in Apollo 8 all those years ago. And then the following year, so 2025, that's when we're really going to be thinking about, can we land some astronauts now on the moon and kick off this whole new chapter of lunar exploration? So we are really talking in the next 5 years to get somebody back down on the lunar surface. And then, of course, from there, the program will just grow. The plan is to start then building infrastructure both on and around the moon, and then seeing what we can do with the moon to benefit us back here on Earth.
Sean Cleaver from the Orion European Service Module Programme. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Olympic organisers look ahead to the 2028 Games with some possible new sports.
Baseball, softball, flag football, lacrosse sixes, squash and cricket.
But before we move on, let's hear about this week's Happy Pod with Andrew Peach.
Yes, there are many things in the world it's hard to feel positive about, one of them being the climate crisis. But we've been talking to the tech giant Bill Gates, and he says there are reasons to look on the bright side. Also this week, scientists in Spain on a new way of spotting breast cancer, the Caribbean island that's been turned from a desolate rock to a wildlife haven, and world records being smashed all over the place, from the fastest marathon in Chicago to the biggest pumpkin in Minnesota. Do join me for the Happy Pod, available in this feed or wherever you get your BBC podcasts every Saturday.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Hundreds of Afghans who risked their lives to work with the UK in Afghanistan have been stuck in Pakistan for months or even longer, having fled from the Taliban. They're waiting to be relocated to Britain, where they're eligible for resettlement. But some say they're now living in fear of deportation as Pakistan has started taking a tougher approach to migrants without visas. Our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davies, has this report.
Karachi's courts have already seen many Afghans in the last few weeks, rounded up in raids, detained, chained, accused of being here illegally. Pakistan's government announced that illegal migrants would be deported in November. It scared many here, particularly the Afghan community. Among the thousands that came to Pakistan after the Taliban government took power are hundreds who risked their lives working for the British, including translators for the British Army, all told by the UK government to come to Pakistan so they could be processed for a UK visa. But they're still waiting, with their children living in hotels in Pakistan, with no legal access to school or work. Some have been here for over a year. Many were too afraid to speak to us. Others only agreed if we didn't use their voices or names, worried if they were identified, it could affect their visa case or their families still in Afghanistan under the Taliban government, despite the Taliban's declared amnesty on those who worked with international forces. This man worked with the UK authorities.
Afghans are all under a lot of stress. Not just my family, but everyone. It has caused all of us psychological problems.
His friend was a translator with the British Army.
We are scared. Our Pakistani visas have expired. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we will be arrested or not.
And they fear they cannot go back.
If we go back, we will be at even more risk than before. Before we left Afghanistan, if our lives were at 50% danger, now they are in 100% danger.
Their passports, they say, are with the UK government. Their Pakistan visas expired. Marzia, not her real name, was a teacher with the British Council. She's heavily pregnant, but says she was told by her caseworker at the International Organisation for Migration not to leave the hotel, even for doctor's appointments. So we speak on the phone.
I don't know what to do. It's impossible for me to give birth to my baby inside my hotel room. There isn't any facility, there isn't anyone to help me. There's a lot of problem and my and my baby's health will be in danger. We work for them, honestly, and it's time for them to help us.
Five others said they were also told the same by their IOM caseworkers or the hotel staff on their behalf. The IOM said it does not give this advice. Marzia told us she's feeling increasingly hopeless. The BBC understands that the UK is in touch with the Pakistan authorities to try to make sure people on these schemes aren't affected, but many we spoke to didn't feel reassured. The UK government told us it's made an ambitious and generous commitment to help at-risk people in Afghanistan and continues to honour its commitments to bring eligible Afghans to the UK. But the main answer those we spoke to want is when.
That report by our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davies. Now to a huge development in the world of gaming. British regulators have approved a $69 billion deal for Microsoft to buy the maker of the Call of Duty video game franchise Activision Blizzard. The US and EU had already backed the deal, the biggest in gaming history, but the UK's competition watchdog originally had concerns. Our business correspondent Mark Ashdown reports.
After a near two-year battle, the biggest takeover in the history of gaming has finally got the green light. Activision Blizzard makes hits like Candy Crush, World of Warcraft, and one of the biggest selling video game series of all time, Call of Duty. Microsoft's takeover bid was blocked in April by the Competition and Markets Authority, which oversees mergers and acquisitions in the UK. The regulator feared the deal would hand Microsoft too much power over the cloud gaming market, where games are bought virtually and can be played on a variety of devices, and could limit the availability of some of the most popular games on rival platforms. A revised deal will now hand the French video game publisher Ubisoft the rights to distribute Activision's titles on PCs and other consoles. The CMA said that would reduce costs for gamers.
Mark Ashdown. More than 100 years after it was last played at the Olympics, cricket could be making a return to the Games. Back in 1900, cricket was one of only 19 sports at the Paris Games, but now it's being considered for Los Angeles in 2028 alongside several other sports after a meeting of the International Olympic Committee in the Indian city of Mumbai. The IOC president is Thomas Back.
These five sports are baseball, softball, flag football, lacrosse sixes, squash and cricket.
But it's not a done deal just yet, as I heard from our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
It now goes to a vote of the full
International Olympic Committee membership when they gather here in Mumbai on Monday. But we fully expect them to ratify what has already, or confirm what has already been told to us by the executive board. They want those five sports in the Olympics. It means a great deal for cricket. It means a great deal for the IOC. Thomas Bach wanted cricket in the Olympics mainly because it would guarantee him a huge following, or the Olympics a huge following, in this part of the world, in the Indian subcontinent, where the game is so big. And he said that in a press conference afterwards, that he expects to grow the audience in this part of the world for the Olympics. He'll also get a windfall as well, because the Indian media broadcasters haven't paid for the rights to broadcast the LA Games in 2028. The last deal was worth around $20 million. This deal, with cricket involved, as is expected, will be worth more than $200 million, so experts have predicted.
Yeah, and you can't really understate how big the audience could be, because we're talking about the most populous nation in the world, India, where cricket is almost like a religion. And it's also a country which traditionally has done very poorly at the Olympics.
Yeah, you're right. And, I mean, if you look at the medal tables over past Olympics, India does not feature high up on the list at all. It used to do quite well at hockey. In fact, they got a bronze medal in hockey at the last Olympics, Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Only two individual gold medals, one in shooting and one in Tokyo, actually, in the javelin. And they would have high expectations of doing well at a cricket Olympic tournament. It will be a shortened tournament, just six teams involved in the short format of the game, the T20 format of the game. But yes, you're right, it's a massive sport here. It's the World Cup in India at the moment, and everywhere you go in the city of Mumbai, indeed it's probably the same all over the country, there are big screens showing whatever game is on at that moment, and lots of Indians glued to the television, glued to their radios in the car, listening to what's happening. They love this sport, and we're talking about, I mean, that's what I was speaking to one media expert who felt that this would guarantee Thomas Bach and his Olympic movement an increase of around 600 to 700 million eyeballs watching the Olympic Games in Los Angeles 2028. So, as Thomas Bach explained, it's a win-win situation.
Alex Capstick, a Japanese man who posted an online video of himself licking a soy sauce bottle at a restaurant, has been given a suspended 3-year prison sentence. As Harry Bly reports, the video was just one of several that went viral, causing widespread outrage.
This video was posted on social media in February. It shows a man licking a communal soy sauce bottle at a sushi restaurant. It happened at Kura Sushi, a chain sushi restaurant in the city of Nagoya. But this wasn't a one-off. It was part of a dozen copycat videos that emerged around the same time, amassing millions of views. Others showed a customer licking his fingers and touching dishes passing by on the conveyor belt. Another saw a man licking a set of chopsticks on someone else's dish and an unused teacup. Immediately, restaurants reacted. Several sushi chains limited the use of the traditional conveyor belts that carry food to diners. Kura Sushi Incorporated, which has 500 restaurants across Japan, installed surveillance cameras equipped with artificial intelligence. And then the police got involved, arresting three people in March on suspicion of public nuisance. On Friday, 21-year-old Ryoga Yoshino appeared at Nagoya District Court, where he was given a 3-year prison sentence, suspended for 5 years. So, why did he do it? He wanted online notoriety. Yoshino told the judge, "I did it to satisfy my desire for recognition and wanted to be popular. What I did was very stupid."
Harry Bly. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Chantal Hartle. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Save on stuff you really need and stuff you bought for fun. Stuff you've always really wanted this holiday at Amazon. Stuff that is discounted if you're naughty or you're nice.
stuff to buy your grandma, who drinks her Chardonnay with ice. Stuff to make you big and strong, stuff we can name in this song. Stuff for lawns and decking.